on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have put their lives on the line for the freedom that you and I enjoy every day. If you grew up in Taft, California, maybe you bought a baseball bat or a tennis racket from our guest today, Victor Killingsworth. For decades, the owner of Taft Sporting Goods. I'm often asked how I find the veterans who appear on Hometown Heroes, and I have to flip that question upside down a bit, because for the most part, I don't find them. They find me, listeners like you, rat them out, so to speak. I want to thank Miguel Sandoval, a loyal listener, for today's program, because he obviously views his father-in-law, Vic Killingsworth, as one of his heroes. He sent me Mr. Killingsworth's book, The Gator Navy, and boy, did I devour it. A great read. So I want to say thanks, Miguel, and by the time we're done, I think all our listeners will be glad that you told me about your father-in-law. All right, well, we left off with you referencing heading overseas and the invasions would be for real. But before we get there, I'm curious to know on those practice landings, because now you can look back and you think about being at Kwajalein and Saipan and Tinian and all these places where you landed troops. Looking back, do you think those practice landings domestically with no real opposition, where in theory it's a safe exercise, do you think that those prepared you for what you eventually encountered?
Well, very, very definitely they prepared us. We had our advanced amphibious training at Fort Pierce, Florida, after we left Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I never experienced anything like the waves that we ran into in Florida. When we had our final run in Florida, we lost 20% of our personnel in that one landing operation. Our boat group commander broke his collarbone, and we had a broken jaw, we had broken teeth, we had broken arms, broken legs. The waves were 10 foot high. I can remember taking some Marines out in my boat, and one getting so sick, he was laying on the bottom of the boat, and I happened to look at him. I wasn't particularly, maybe I was smiling, I don't know, but he looked at me and he said, if I ever get out of this landing boat, you'll never get me in another one. It was rough at night. We lost 20% of our crew. I fortunately was able to help out quite a bit that night. And I didn't get hurt. And so they replaced all of our officers and crew members within days. We were, because they were ready to ship us overseas, they had to replace them quickly.
And again, this is just training here in the States before you ever went overseas. And just to be clear, when you say you lost 20% of the crew, you mean they were injured, not that they were killed.
They were just injured, like you say, with broken legs, broken arms. We had a really bad night that particular night.
Well, I could see how that would get your attention. Getting back to the West Coast, you said that the next time you guys were going for real and the next time the Marines would hit the beach was an enemy beach, but you actually almost missed your ship. There's a pretty good story there. You had to play a little catch-up, right? Tell me how that happened. This was the Sumter?
Yeah, the Sumter. Well, we came into San Diego, and while we were on the East Coast, I stood a lot of extra watches so the guys could go home and so they owed me. So we came to the West Coast. I said, you guys are going to have to pick up the slack because I'm going to have to go on liberty. So they did, and I went on liberty. When I came back, my ship was gone. I walked down the docks and looked around, and no, how can you lose a ship? But we did. And so as I was standing there wondering what the heck happened to my ship, a shore patrol guy came up and he said, sir, are you looking for your ship? And I said, yeah, what happened to it? And he said, well, they had to move. They went to San Pedro for repairs. So the captain had left his Jeep there, and I wasn't the only one that missed it. It was four of us. The other three officers took the Jeep and went to San Pedro and left me. So
how'd they leave you? Did they know you were missing too?
I don't know how they left me, but... But anyway, I hitchhiked, took taxis, and took me all night. I pulled into San Pedro at the docks there about 6 o'clock in the morning, thinking I was going to catch the very devil from the captain, and or worse. And when I came aboard ship, the officer of the deck said the captain wants to see it. I thought, oh boy, I'm in for it now. So when I went to his stateroom, he apologized for leaving me, and he had coffee and sweet rolls, and so we had a great time. My fellow officer told me that I was the luckiest guy in the Navy. Everything I did was came out of it smelling like a rose. So
I've read your book. I kind of have to agree with them. The way it all worked out for you, somebody was looking out for you, that's for sure. And we're looking at some maps here right in front of us as we record this show today at the studios of KNZR, the affiliate in Bakersfield and Kern County that airs Hometown Heroes. We appreciate their hospitality. And out laid on the table here are invasion maps. One of them says top secret, confidential, only in combat area. And this was the first invasion that you were part of, right? This is Kwajalein we're looking at.
Yes, this was the invasion of Kwajalein Atoll. I had a rather unique part in this one. They asked for volunteers to take some Marines in D-1, and I volunteered because I thought it sounded like a great adventure.
What's wrong with you? D-1, this is before everyone's going to hit the island. So basically you're going in with a skeleton crew, knowing there's tons of Japanese and tons of guns on this island, and you're basically tiptoeing your way onto this island and hoping nobody catches you. What possessed you to volunteer for that kind of duty?
I really don't know now looking back on it, but at the time I thought it was a good idea. So I volunteered, and the USS Sumter, which is a ship I was on, it was an APA 52.
So that's a ship from which all of these landing craft launch.
Well, we have a flotilla of ships. But anyway, as we got near Kauai, well, first of all, I should say, the first night after we left San Diego, or maybe it wasn't the first night, the first few nights, we pulled in behind the big island of Hawaii. And this was our first experience with war. Tokyo Rose came on the radio that night and told us we were hiding out on the, behind it, and suggested that we turn around and go back because the Japanese had many body bags waiting for us, that we would not go home, we would not see our wives or our loved ones. And so that was kind of a shocker that she knew where we were at and where we were going. But as a fun thing, on the way there, I was standing watch. And after watch one night, I went in to get a cup of coffee. And the stewards are black, at those days were black stewards. And they had access to the officers' wardroom because they did our cooking and also served their meals. And so they also could eat whatever they wanted that was around there. So they were in the wardroom having a snack, and I went in and had a cup of coffee, and I was sitting where I could hear them. And they're all guessing where we were going. They guessed all over the Pacific. And there was one older gentleman. He was about, I say older, he was probably in his 30s. They were probably in their teens, late teens. And finally I heard him say, "Boys, I don't care where I was going. I just like to look back and see where I've been." And I've always thought about that. A great way to think, philosophy of life. Yeah. But anyway, we, for this voluntary thing, that when we got close to Kwajalein, our team was pulled away from the amphibious forces, got in within a mile or so of the island, and blacked out. We had no lights on at that time as we cruised in. And they put me over the side in my landing boat, and then they put the Marine scouts, it was about, I think, a couple dozen or so Marine scouts, in rubber boats. And it was a horrible night. There was no moon. It was pitch dark. Rain was pouring down, as I recall, and the swells were 8-10 foot high. It was an awful night.
Were you starting to think maybe you shouldn't have volunteered?
Yeah, I was wondering whether we were going to make it, really. I didn't know how those little rubber boats looked like ducks. Yeah. So anyway, they tied them behind my landing boat. And
is this a LCVP or what?
Yeah, LCVP. And I took a compass bearing on the island, and I towed them in close to the island. and then cut them loose. And they paddled in the rubber boats. My orders were to report the next. I had the radio and was in touch with the fleet. And so it all depended on what I did. We had two landing plans, one to go inside the lagoon, one to go outside. If we had to go outside, we would have had hundreds more casualties. So we wanted to go inside if we could.
So you're scouting out this lagoon to see if you can land there the next day?
Yeah. Well, there's an island called Jacob, which is a short distance from the main islands. And there was a passageway where the bigger ships could go right off Jacob Island. So we took the scouts in and cut them loose, and they paddled in. And then they told me that I was to go in the next morning and find out whether they had taken the island so they'd know which plan A or plan B.
So if they were successful, you guys would have a passageway on this attack that would greatly increase your chances of survival and reducing those casualties.
The only problem is they did not give me orders as to what to do after I cut the Marines loose. So here I am out in the ocean, pitch dark, pouring down rain, heavy swells, wondering what the heck am I going to do for the next 3 or 4 hours.
How many guys did you have on the boat with you?
I had just four men. I had two gunners, a coxswain, and a mechanic. So I told the boys, I said, we got to do something. We can't stay out here in this weather. We'll be swamped. Rain was really coming down hard. So I decided to go inside the lagoon and where it was out of the weather, and we can make it. So we did go inside the Kwajalein Atoll and run up and down. I was concerned about whether we're going to run out of fuel, but we had our tanks full when we started. So we ran up and down inside this Japanese atoll till it was daylight. And then we worked our way back and picked our way through the coral reefs and landed on the beach on the lee side of the Jacob Island, hoping that the Marine colonel who was in charge of the Marines would come out of the brush.
Yeah, that's what struck me. And you tell that story very beautifully in your book, The Gator Navy. I was just imagining myself in your shoes, and that uncertainty that, I mean, we watch television, we want the cliffhanger, right? Or we watch the end of a basketball game, we want to see if that buzzer beater is going to go in. And to me, that seems like the kind of moment where the sun comes up and you're there and you're waiting, is it going to be the Marines or the Japanese, right?
As we pulled into the beach, I had both the gunners had two 30 caliber machine guns trained on the brush, and the other mechanic and the coxswain had carbines. I had my 45 pistol. I don't know what we thought we would do if a group of Japanese came out, but about the time this was happening, we all ran into another problem. There was a sand spit that sort of controlled the entry to this harbor, and there was a Japanese gun emplacement on it. And they apparently had their heads down with all the rain and so on. They weren't sticking their heads up out of that gun emplacement. About the time I saw that, I'm thinking, uh-oh. We're in trouble. You know what's coming from the front. You don't know what's going to happen from the back. But a Marine Corsair fighter plane came over low over the water, and he spotted them, and he took them out with his guns on his plane. So about that time, the Marine colonel came out of the brush waving the Japanese sword over his head. He said, Swabby, called me a Swabby. He said, call the fleet, tell them we got them. I said, how many did you get? He said, we killed about 30, so with knives and bayonets while they were asleep. So we took that little island of Jacob, and immediately they started bringing in Marine artillery, and the 10th Marine artillery set up on that island, and then they began pounding the Japanese from on the backside of Roy and Namur.
And there were no casualties, right, from your group?
No, the Marines didn't suffer one casualty. And they did it quietly. They didn't want to make any racket or noise because the Japanese could have reinforced the island real quickly from one of the bigger islands. So they had no indication until we started pounding with the artillery from the backside.
And we can look back now and see how successful that operation at Kwajalein was. But what I got from your book was, without that part of it, and you called it Operation Flintlock, I think, right? Operation Flintlock, without that and what you and those other guys who volunteered for that duty did, the whole battle could have been a lot different, right?
It would have been different. We The Marines suffered around 300-400 casualties, and the Japanese suffered 8,000 casualties. So by going in on the backside, it saved a lot of American lives. Yeah.
Well, and the one thing you described there, too, I want our listeners to understand, your life was saved there, too, it sounds like. If that Corsair hadn't swooped down at that right spot, maybe you guys wouldn't have survived?
That's right. It was Nipponhook. So everything worked out, thankfully. Yeah.
So I guess you're probably a fan of Marine Corps pilots, huh?
I'm a fan of Marines. I have nothing but respect for Marines, especially the fighting Marines.
And I imagine the folks listening today, Marines or otherwise, are starting to develop some respect for you and what you did, not to mention the great job you've done preserving it all in your book, The Gator Navy. More information on that at hometownheroesradio.com, and as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you're on Facebook, just type in Hometown Heroes Radio, and you'll see photos of many, many of our guests over the years. More of Victor Killingsworth's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.